Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Randall v. Johnson.
May it please the court, Ms. Holly H. Williamson represents argument from petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case arises out of a real-world problem that was dropped into the lap of a real-world employer. The decision of the Court of Appeals in this case ignored completely the practical realities that face real-world employers such as Randall's.
Could you speak louder?
Yes, ma'am. The practical realities of employers such as Randall's who are attempting to investigate reports of wrongdoing that they have received from one of their employees. In failing to deal with the practical realities, the opinion of the Court of Appeals does not recognize or apply the proper standards, and consequently it ties the hands of employers who are attempting to get to the bottom of reports of wrongdoing. The Court of Appeals with its decision has in effect made it a risky proposition for employers to venture into an investigation when they receive a report of wrongdoing by an employee about another employee. And what we're asking this court to do in this case is to first reaffirm the employer's ability to investigate reports of wrongdoing and to reaffirm the employer's right to direct the duties, the projects, and the locations of their employees when their employees are at work and being paid. We're also asking for the court's guidance in helping the employers throughout the state in determining how to conduct these investigations and, you know, what they need to do to make sure that these investigations are conducted properly.
Ms. Williamson, I'm a little bit confused about some of the facts in this case. There is at least allegations that the security guard was questioning individuals about Ms. Johnson's conduct in the public area of the facility near a deli or someplace where customers were hanging around, and that his questioning was in front of all these people that are out there. On the other hand, it's not clear that there's any allegation that anybody overheard what he was saying. I don't know the context, and it's not clear from, at least from what I've read so far, what we're talking about.
I agree, Justice Enoch. It's a little confusing. What we have is undisputed that there were some interviews of some of the employees conducted by the security guard in the coffee shop or the deli at the Randall's Galveston store. And there's been no allegation that anyone overheard these interviews. But it was the concern or the allegation is that persons who witnessed these interviews might infer that there was something going on, or that Ms. Johnson was in trouble, or that Ms. Johnson was being accused of some wrongful conduct. The undisputed summary judgment evidence shows, however, that this particular security guard, a deputy Galang, said that he conducted the interviews in the back of the deli, away from where other people were, that they conducted these discreetly, and that if anyone else showed up or approached them, that they would, you know, stop talking. And so the undisputed summary judgment evidence is...
And that's in that they would stop talking about it if somebody approached them, that's in the summary judgment?
Yes, sir, it is. It's in the summary judgment record.
Okay.
Does that answer your question, Justice?
Well, that's what I need to look at. Okay.
This case arose out of some reports that were made by two subordinate employees who worked for the Randall store in Galveston. And these subordinate employees, of course, are Scotty Kettner and Frank Davis. And the person that they made the reports about was Mary Lynn Johnson, who was the non-foods manager of the store at that time. The key to both of these situations is that Randall's management did not leap to the conclusion that the reports were true or that they were accurate Instead, what Randall's management did is what you would expect an employer to do under these circumstances, and that they conducted and engaged in an investigation. And indeed, you would expect an employer to be able to engage in and conduct an investigation under these circumstances. And based upon these investigations that Randall's did, it exonerated Ms. Johnson in the Kettner incident. And in the Davis case, the investigation came up inconclusive.
Ms. Williamson, you're not contending, are you, for any special standards that apply to employers in this context for false imprisonment, intentional infliction of emotional distress, or defamation, are you?
Well, in terms...
Other than perhaps the privilege that you claim to confront someone with a report of misconduct?
Yes, sir. Justice Cornyn, I think we are. In addition to the conditional privilege that an employer has, as a matter of public policy, to investigate reports of wrongdoing, I think that when you're talking about an allegation of false imprisonment in a case like this, that, for example, the Court of Appeals said that when you detain someone and keep them from going in the direction they want to go, that may be evidence of false imprisonment. And you can't apply that standard in an employment context because the employer has the right to be able to dictate to its employees where he or she wants their employees to go and, you know, where they can and can't go on the workplace premises. So to the extent that the law is, as far as false imprisonment goes, that you can not detain someone from going in the direction they want to go, we certainly have to have an exception in the employment context. I personally don't believe that can be the law, that it's applied so strictly that false imprisonment will, or it'll be a fact issue of false imprisonment simply because someone was detained from going in the direction they want to go. I believe the Court of Appeals applies that standard a little bit too narrowly and technically in this case. Does that answer your question? As I mentioned a moment ago, two investigations were conducted. And Ms. Johnson, even though she was exonerated with respect to the investigation that was conducted in the Scotty Kettner case, she complains about both of the investigations. What we've got from the Court of Appeals is an opinion that provides us with no guidance and little explanation as to how it came to the conclusion that Randall's or the petitioner had not conclusively established their right to a conditioner case. And that with respect to the Kettner case, how they failed to conclusively show an absence of malice. The court, with respect to the Kettner allegation, applied a malice standard that I don't think was viable at that point and certainly is not viable in light of this court's concurrent opinion that was issued last week denying the application for writ of error in the Hagler case. The malice standard that the Court of Appeals, it gave lip service to the true malice standard, and then what it said is because two managers may have discussed the Kettner allegations in the context of their investigation, that the mere repetition of the Kettner allegations would give rise to an inference of malice. And as I think we've known for a long time, and now it's been clarified by this court, that's certainly not the standard for malice. It's whether they repeated those allegations with knowledge that they were false or with reckless disregard for the truth. Until now, I believe that employers were under the impression that they had a conditional privilege to investigate reports of wrongdoing, and as long as the communications that were made during the context of the investigation were continued with the group of people who had an interest in the matter and were made with people who might have information that was necessary to conduct the investigation, that the privilege would attach not only to the report, but the privilege would go ahead and continue to protect the communications that were made in the context of the investigation. Until now, I believe that employers could rely on the privilege as long as they didn't abuse it. And the only allegations, as far as Ms. Johnson goes, of abuse is the conduct of the interviews in the deli. So I think that Ms. Johnson has recognized that a conditional privilege arises, but she thinks that it was abused because of the interviews in the deli. The until now, the employers could kind of rest easy with the knowledge that if they received true reports, that if they were later challenged, that they wouldn't have to defend themselves in the court of law. And what we have here with respect to the Davis report is our reports that are admittedly true. And what the Court of Appeals said is, well, in conducting your investigation, even though these reports may have been true, that those who were involved in the investigation, basically simply because there was an investigation, may have inferred that there was something more sinister, that she stole the wreath or that she was a thief. And this basically, you know, turns the investigative right on its head. If any time that there's going to be an investigation, there's going to be some question as to whether there's going to be wrongdoing on the part of the person that's being investigated or the incident being investigated. And so the Court of Appeals has applied standard here by an inappropriate standard here by saying that even though the reports may be true, the fact that someone may infer from the investigation or from the report something more sinister gives rise to an inference of slander, which would, you know, defeat the defense of truth. The Court of Appeals basically concluded that the petitioners had not proven conclusively that they were entitled to invoke their conditional privilege, and that the petitioners could not establish the truth of all of those inferences, as I mentioned a moment ago. They also said that petitioners had not established exactly what was published, and what the petitioners, and with respect to the Davis reports did, is they were able to establish the content of what was published throughout the investigation. I cannot believe that the Court of Appeals would require us to establish the literal language that was used by everyone through the course of this investigation. To do that, we would have had to have brought in a court reporter or had a tape recorder sitting there during the course of the reports and the investigation. With respect to the Kettner allegations, the petitioners conclusively proved that they simply received her reports, that they investigated her report, they looked into her reports, and they found that Ms. Kettner had undermined Mrs. Johnson. And I believe that if anyone probably has a complaint about that investigation, it's probably Scotty Kettner rather than Lynn Johnson. The Court of Appeals didn't question the petitioner's conditional privilege when it was talking about the Scotty Kettner matters, but rather jumped into the malice issue, as I mentioned a moment ago, where they obviously apply the wrong standard for the malice issue. And in addition to reciting the wrong standard or applying the wrong standard, I think they recited the right standard but applied the wrong standard, they recited that there was some evidence in the record that Simmons and Seals were talking about the Scotty Kettner incident with some third parties, and that's just not supported by the record. The record conclusively establishes that with respect to these Kettner allegations, the only statements that were made were in the context of the managers talking among themselves about this particular problem and how to deal with it. And at the end of the day, what happened is they concluded that Ms. Kettner had indeed been undermining Ms. Johnson, and they exonerated Ms. Johnson. Now, if the Court of Appeals' opinion in the defamation claims were not onerous enough for employers to try and deal with, I think that the Court of Appeals' opinion went to great extremes to make the management of employees virtually impossible when it ignored, I think, precedent and twisted precedent and found evidence of false imprisonment in the petitioner's exercise of its right to limit Ms. Johnson's movements to certain parts of the store when she was at the store. Ms. Johnson consented to remain at the store so that she could talk to her district manager. The Court of Appeals, in dealing with the issue of intentional infliction of emotional distress, seemed to conclude that because the petitioners had asked Ms. Johnson to explain to them what it was that happened on the night of the Reed incident, that that in some way, shape, or form would give rise to an inference of outrageous conduct. And with respect to employment disputes. If employers are now going to have to defend themselves on the basis of claims of outrage and extreme conduct, if they bring an employee in and ask the employee for an explanation for an incident or for a report of wrongdoing, then employees are not going to be able to defend themselves or investigate reports of employee wrongdoing. Does the court have any questions?
Any questions? Thank you, Kim. The court is ready to hear argument from the spot.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark W. Stevens will present argument for respondent.
Please, the court. First off, a briefing question very quickly. I had filed on October 6th this small brief. Did the court receive this? We only paid the fee the other day. Okay. This is a summary judgment case. It's one in which the defendants have the burden of proving, as a matter of law, either that some element of the plaintiff's case is lacking or that they have some affirmative defense. The odd thing is, usually summary judgment cases, not always, but usually, they turn on the sufficiency of affidavits. And in this kind of case, it would have seemed most simple, and I address counsel's remark about cluttering the record, confusing the record, it would have seemed most simple for the individual defendants involved to line up and say who knew what and when, because one of the key components of this is who knew and how early what Frank Davis knew, that is, as we've laid out, that he had set his boss up. That was not done. They tried to make do with an affidavit from a man in Houston who was not a witness or participant in these matters, a conclusory affidavit. They tried to make do with snippets of the record, and we came in and told you, as Paul Harvey says, the rest of the story. The Reef incident. Before I get to the Reef incident, I hadn't intended to talk about Scotty Ketter, but let me do so just for a minute. What we're really talking about, the so-called investigation sprang, and this is petitioner's application, from some of Mrs. Kettner's correspondence. She's writing to Mr. Gillespie, enclosed a copy this is tab C to their application, of the complaint that was submitted at store level to Lewis Simmons. On another document, elsewhere, I believe, in one of the typewritten documents, she indicates that more signatures have been asked for. What signatures is she talking about? She's talking about signatures attached to this vicious little diatribe, beginning at page 266 of the record, of people who identify themselves as customers in the store. When did that happen? It happened in June of 1989 when Mrs. Johnson was at home having a troubled baby. They couldn't possibly have been investigating anything. And one has only to read the face sheet of that document to tell that Scotty Kettner was, to put it kindly, an ambitious person who was not to be trusted, and that should have seen the light of day. Instead, it saw the light of circulation all around the store that Mrs. Johnson had started up 4 years before.
Now, is that in the sum of, to what claim do you attach the significance of that letter in your lawsuit?
We sued on the basis of that claim being circulated around the store, and we also...
To whom do you allege that was circulated to? I mean...
The general public. There are signatures all over the back of that document, Your Honor.
So it was circulated, and who circulated it?
Scotty Kettner.
And at the time she was an employee of the...
She was a subordinate of Lynn Johnson's, who then was absent.
Now, as a part of your claim against Randall's, you're claiming that that was defamatory, the circulation of that was defamatory.
Yes, sir. That and subsequent discussions of Ms. Kettner's with managers saying a little bit more clearly that Lynn Johnson was stealing cosmetics.
Okay, now that is currently a claim pending here?
That's our position, yes, sir. The point of error was sustained by the Court of Appeals and en masse. So the entire congeries of Kettner claims were reversed.
So your claim is not that the two managers repeated what she said.
It is.
Your claim is in the first instance
her statements that were circulated to customers?
It is that in addition, and I'd point out just very briefly, if I may move on, one of the key incidents that was repeated did not take place in June of 1989. It took place in November of 1990 when Mike Seals, on his second trip up to see the people in Houston, chose to repeat those allegations once again as a way of driving the nail in Mrs. Johnson's coffin.
Now, he repeated those to his superiors.
The record says something to this effect. I believe it's either Barclay's or Gillespie's affidavit. He says, yes, at about that time, I believe he did, meaning he, Mr. Seals, mentioned the Kettner matter.
To his superiors.
To his superiors, yes, sir. Okay.
So you claim not only damages resulting from Seals' repetition of what Kettner said, but you also have a live cause of action that you claim you have for Kettner's first comments to those customers.
Yes, sir, but to be candid, the real significance of it is it weighs much more heavily on what defendant manager Mike Seals' attitude was at that time, what his motivations were. Was he bona fide investigating something, or was he just trying to get rid of an employee? Does that answer the court's question?
It helps clarify some of our...
The Reef incident. This reef is as big as an elephant's earring. It is enormous. It's 42 inches wide. Mrs. Johnson had certainly a very reasonable expectation that when she approached the counter with a bunch of items in this reef, that it would get rung up by somebody. She will be the first to admit she wasn't watching what she was doing. She had other packages. She had preoccupations at home. It might be a different case. No, it would be a different case if she had just come out of the blue with this reef from nowhere and, you know, Frank Davis was a little bit confused or something. But this was premeditated. The record also includes memoranda taken the following day that show that 3 hours before this, Frank Davis was told to make sure this reef gets paid for before it leaves the store. That's his version of what he was told. I think the truth begins to creep out in the other one, Jeannie Weiss's, when she said, see if she pays for it. And when I questioned her in her deposition, and this is in the record, that lady broke down in tears and had to leave and recompose herself and come back in. In his deposition, all over the summary judgment record, Mr. Davis, again, a subordinate of Lynn Johnson's, says that, yeah, he knew he was supposed to make specific inquiry if there was any question. He knew he was supposed to bring it specifically to the customer's attention and either get a receipt. Yes.
Are you saying you're being specific about the reef? Where is that? That he was told to check if the reef was being paid.
In this, I'll make it real easy. There's a tab. I have repeated Frank Davis's testimony at this point, summary of Davis record in this
case. Is that what you've just found?
Yes, ma'am, but it also occurs in this one. I just
Appendix B, I think.
Ma'am?
To Appendix B to your reply.
To the reply, let me find the reply. So, okay, quickly. Appendix B is the statement of Frank Davis, the one-page statement that was taken in the deli. C is that of Jeannie Weiss. And Frank Davis's testimony, actually, the deposition pages are beginning at 421, are tab D, and they are summarized internally in the brief, and that summarization is what appears in the supplement in tab A. He knew he was supposed to do these things. I asked him, let me go directly from it.
Which rubric does this fall under? If there was a setup, is that intentional infliction of emotional distress? Or?
I don't think you need to go that far. This is slander. He knew very well when he went to
the... Do we have jurisdiction over the slander part of this case?
Yeah. You mean to reverse it?
Well, we'll look at it.
I think some people looking at the jurisdictional challenge in my brief might gather perhaps I'm not terribly well schooled in that. The rubric I've been given is that you have jurisdiction over legal standards, but not over factual questions. In Hagler a few weeks ago, that was pure Article 5, Section 6, as far as I can see. I don't think the court issued an opinion. It simply denied writ, and presumably may have done so because it was a factual sufficiency question. I don't know if that's responsive, but...
Not entirely, but we...
The answer is, that will be up to the court under the current state of the law. We raised it. If you don't have jurisdiction, then it goes back anyway. But if it goes back for that reason, it'll never come back up. I guess that's where it leaves us. Let me complete just a trip through this. Davis admitted it was his responsibility. I've said that. When asked why he didn't do these things, just go ahead and charge for it, he said, I don't know. When asked if it was his intention not to bring the wreath to Mrs. Johnson's attention, he answered, I don't recall. He knew that Mrs. Johnson, his boss, would be in jeopardy the instant she crossed the store threshold. And just by the way, folks, he didn't like
it. No, I was inquiring about your statement that he would caution to be sure she paid for the wreath.
That is Frank Davis's statement, tab D to my response. Came to see me and told me to make sure the wreath in the back room was paid for before it left the store. None of this pantomime stuff where you let her go out and then mount an investigation behind her back and the next day. That's what was going on here. The problem that Randall's really has in this case is that its people knew too much about this, starting with Frank Davis, and too soon. Jimmy Galland's deposition establishes that Lewis Simmons knew the substance of that report that I just read to tab D the next day, Wednesday, the 28th of November, at least that much. And so what we had was, and how did he describe it to his boss? He said, she left the store with a wreath without paying for it. Does that describe accurately what happened? Is that misleading in terms of some of the slander cases that have come out? It sure is. What it does is it gives you an idea that somebody has perhaps stuck a small wreath in or secreted or something like that. Not any idea of what's happened here.
Let me understand the facts.
Yes.
When she carried the wreath out, she'd gone through a checkout counter, paid for other items.
It was a checkout stand, yes. A
checkout stand, and she had the wreath and other items. She paid. She stopped. They rang it up. She paid. She left the store.
She paid with a check. She pulled, I guess, her checkbook out and wrote whatever amount was called out and split it. And then when she was confronted with it a couple of days later, she pulled her checkbook out, said, yeah, I did, and oops, and it wasn't enough. Clearly wasn't. And what was going on was that Frank Davis, not in his words about it, was setting his boss up. The serious part of it is that you've got to ask yourself intuitively, why would Frank Davis do something like this to his boss if he wasn't absolutely sure he could get away with it? And it's fact questions like that that need to be answered by a jury in this case. I want to turn quickly to false imprisonment and intentional infliction. TELC filed a brief the other day in which they were very candid about it, admirably so. They said, hey, you know, we don't like the risk of this sort of thing. Well, businessmen, capitalists, take risks every day. They take risks that their people will go out and get drunk and take a company truck and run over somebody and do a lot of damage. They should at least take the risk that their people will intentionally injure somebody and their reputation when their own managers know what's going on, as so clearly happened here. Let me add one more detail, and this also is all over the summary judgment record.
What?
Frank Davis didn't get disciplined at all. Frank Davis, it's in here, forgive me, got a merit increase on December 6th,
How does that prove false imprisonment?
Okay, they proved it by their own memorandum. At page 373 of the record, the sealed Simmons record, the privilege they have is statutory, actually. It's contained in 124.001 of the Civil Practices Remedy Code, and it says if you reasonably believe somebody has stolen something, which by that time wasn't true, you may reasonably detain them for a reasonable period of time to investigate ownership of the property. Well, If they had any right to do anything, it might have been, arguably, to call Mrs. Johnson in, and I don't even concede this, and ask her, did you pay for it or not? By that time, however, they already knew.
You did not concede.
Yes, ma'am.
You did not concede.
I do not, because they already knew that Frank Davis had effectively tried to set his boss up. But what clearly, and this borders into the intentional infliction of emotional distress, what clearly went far beyond the pale is what happened next. After Mrs. Johnson explained her side of the story to Manager Simmons, the store manager, with her sitting there, he calls up and says, she says she forgot or something like that without telling all the facts that she had indicated and apparently without mentioning the size of the reef. Mike Seals transmits that report to his manager, Ron Barkley, and Barkley authorizes a 30-day unpaid suspension at the end of which time she will be offered another job at an hourly rate, about half a rate of pay, at another store.
Now, how does that report?
What
I mean, I'm not saying these are irrelevant. I'm just having a hard time plugging your argument into the outline you've given.
The Court of Appeals, what the Court of Appeals said comes right to the heart. What they were doing was not investigating ownership of property, and it was not bona fide. They knew by that time, they knew, certainly Simmons knew, as of noon on Wednesday the 28th. That was the day all this stuff was going on in the deli. He knew the substance of these reports, and he knew, as I say, that Lynn Johnson essentially had been set up. This was a situation where she should have been charged for it. Yes, sir.
Help me understand. I was trying to understand the case from your perspective.
Yeah.
And you mentioned set up several times. Help me understand. What are you talking about? How was she set up? Did somebody put the reef under her arm?
No, she presented it for payment.
Did somebody suggest to her not to pay for it?
She presented it for payment. And what he did, what Frank Davis did, was he violated the store's understood policy. Their policy was to clarify situations. He saw the reef and he saw the price tag. That's very important to understand. He saw all of it. He knew, and he testified this, he knew she'd be in jeopardy when she left, but instead of following that policy of just going ahead and either charging for her, putting it on her tag, and charging that amount, or asking her, what about the reef?
Does this store have a scanner? Scans.
I don't believe that was in use. This was a side, it does, but I don't think that was a system in use. This was a side area in what's called a service center.
Is he the individual who checked her out? Is he the checker?
Yes, he's the checker.
He's the checker.
Frank Davis is the person who checked her out. He checked the groceries out, but not the reef.
And he says that he saw the price on it and everything?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Didn't recall whether the word, by the way, he didn't recall whether the word theft was used in reporting Mrs. Johnson's activities.
And he's the one that said she left without paying for it?
That's right.
Well, but yet he was the one that was standing there.
That's right. That's exactly right. Mrs. Johnson placed the reef where Davis could see it along with the price tag, and Mrs. Johnson was not concealing the reef, 431.
Did she place the items on the counter except this one? How did it occur?
I think it was something like that. The reef, if she placed it on the counter, she'd have to hang it around his neck, okay? It was very large, very visible. She had several other things. She'd be the first to tell you she's fatigued. She'd been on her feet all day, wanted to get home.
Didn't he ask her if that was all?
He did, but then if you read his deposition.
Recognizing that the reef had not been paid for.
But then, again, recognizing that, yes, but that's a catchphrase. And he was not doing what he was taught to do, and that is to bring these items specifically to her attention, to the customer's attention.
He did not ask her specifically about the reef.
He did not.
He saw it in her possession. He saw the price tag.
That's
and
right.
The other items.
He knew she'd be in jeopardy, and he offered to help her out.
That's we don't need a jury argument.
I'm sorry.
I'm
yes, thank you.
Trying to find out.
And he offered to help her out of the store, knowing that she would be in jeopardy the moment she crossed that threshold.
Ms. Stevens, on the
yes,
on the false imprisonment issue, yes, or the detention issue, she was free to leave the office where she was.
Was she? Now, what had happened? What had happened there?
Well, you know, I understand from the summary judgment record, she in fact left the office, didn't she?
She was put back into a small room to quote-unquote work on the Dickens on the Strand business.
Are you, no, I'm
confused. Are you talking about the office where she was first interviewed or where she was sent?
I don't know about two offices.
Okay.
The allegation is that she was called to the office, and there she was with one of the individuals, not the security officer, but one of the managers, and she was told to remain there because another manager may want to come see her. And I understand that's the basis for the false imprisonment.
That's right.
The unlawful detention.
And because they had nothing to investigate by then.
But my question was, she was free to leave at any time, was she not?
I don't believe she was for this reason, Your Honor.
And my question is, does the summary judgment evidence reflect that in fact she did leave?
She left twice, briefly, once for what I take to be a personal call of some kind, and again to pay for that reason.
Is that not inconsistent with the position that she was not free to leave?
No, sir, it's not. Here's why. Here's something that I think is very important for the court to understand about the special status the counsel is requesting. What happened to her record was they brought this to her attention, she produced her checkbook, and then she said, there was a discussion, she said, are you accusing me of theft? And what her manager, Mr. Simmons, said was, it doesn't look too good for you, or words to that effect. Okay? From that point on, even though he didn't say we're formally charging you, she was impliedly under a threat of prosecution. A person in that position, the worst imaginable thing they can do is to leave. It looks bad. It may even be flight. It may be evidence against them. They've got to stay put. So with those words, what he did was he uncorked the strongest item in his battery. He said, you've got to stay here because you're under the strongest suspicion. This isn't in the ordinary course of business. This is placing a person in fear of prosecution. My time is up. Are there other questions?
What was the total bill that she paid?
About $11. Counsel accurately recites that.
And
the reef was $25.
The price of the reef was more than twice as much as what she paid for the other items.
Yes, sir.
That didn't register with her at the time.
No, sir, it didn't. She had, as I say, she had other packages, everything else. She was encumbered, had things on her mind from kids to this Dickens on the Strand project she was working on.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, can you enlighten us on status of the court's jurisdiction over slander case?
Yes, Justice Phillips, I can. Yesterday, and you probably haven't had a chance to look at it, I filed supplemental or reply brief, and I apologize for getting it in so late. On page 5 and 6 of that brief, I addressed the jurisdictional issue in the slander. And in what I informed the court is that there are two cases, Stafford versus Stafford. It's a 1987 Texas Supreme Court case, and Harry Elder's Company versus T.S. Lankford & Sons, which is a 1963 Texas Supreme Court case, where the courts have, this court has held that when the court has subject matter jurisdiction over points of error that it granted with respect to, for example, false imprisonment or intentional infliction of emotional distress, it also acquires jurisdiction over the entire case.
Okay, thank you.
With respect to Justice Gonzalez's question about the scanner, Justice Gonzalez, yes, there indeed was a scanner. It's not in the record. It may be in the record. I'm not sure. I'll look for it and supplement it.
Well, if there's a scanner, whose responsibility is it to scan the item? Certainly the clerk or the cashier. Correct? The person that's in charge of getting the money for the items. So why wasn't the rescanned?
What the evidence shows is, and I'm going to back up if you don't mind so I can prop this into context, and I think this will also address Justice Spector's question. Jeannie Weiss, who was an assistant manager of the store, said in her statement that Mr. Stevens referred to that she had noticed this big reef in the back room of the service center. The service center is where you buy your videotapes and your watches and your cigarettes and things like that. Not the main part of the store. And there's a back room that's off from the public. The public doesn't know what's the back room. And she saw this big wreath and she asked Mr. Davis, whose wreath is that? And he said, well, that belongs to Miss Johnson. She says in her statement, I had seen Miss Johnson use cosmetics and merchandise from the store without paying for it, so I told Mr. Davis, see if or make sure that she pays for it. Well, 3 hours later, is when Ms. Johnson checked out. She could have checked out with that wreath at any register in the store at any point in time during the day. And what Mr. Davis testified to is that he attempted to ask her through, is there anything else? if she wanted to present that wreath for payment. He did see it. He did see the price tag. And she said, no, that is all I have to pay for. And that's undisputed. It's in the record. And so she went ahead and left. He had in mind the instructions. Jeannie Weiss had given him instructions earlier. He had in mind his assistant manager's instructions. He went to her and said, she didn't pay me for the wreath. And that's what triggered the whole investigation. So the question then becomes, at that point, were the petitioners entitled to start their investigation, and was that qualifiedly privileged? And it seems that the qualified privilege is triggered automatically. And the question of whether the statements are true or untrue comes into the issue of malice.
Ms. Williamson, I have a question on the issue of Pettner's original statements. Is there some sort of cause of action before us on Kettner's original statements?
No, sir. There is not. And there's no contention that we circulated the documents that she provided to us. I think the contention is that we should have stopped her. And basically, we were just trying to get to the bottom of it, concluded it was a personality conflict, and told Ms. Kettner that she was out of line, that she was undermining Ms. Johnson, and then she resigned.
But as to whether some of the parties in this litigation are being sued for Kettner's original conduct in circulating that petition, that's not a part of this lawsuit.
I don't think it should be a part of this lawsuit. I think instead it's being attempted to be injected into this lawsuit.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the court's argument and the second part of the